Old Hollywood is out and the new Hollywood is in. Motion pictures produced from behind a computer desk and in 3D appear to be the future of the movie business, and the ruling monarchy is already in place. In The Men Who Would Be King, an almost epic tale of moguls, moves, and a company called DreamWorks, Nicole Laporte tells the story of three men, David Geffen, Jeffrey Katzenberg, and Steven Spielberg, and their vision of a new kind of American motion picture. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased that it brings Nicole Laporte to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And we should point out that although our names are similar, they're not the same.
True.
We're not related, right?
Right. Correct.
No nepotism involved
yeah.
here. Where did the idea for DreamWorks get started?
For me, for reporting?
No, no, them.
They, well, you know, it was 1994, and Jeffrey Katzenberg, who had been the chairman at Disney, where he'd been largely responsible for reviving the studio and bringing breathing life back into animated films such as The Lion King and Aladdin and Little Mermaid, had actually just been fired in August of 1994. And it just came together, sort of, that's sort of what prompted these three friends to come together. Steven Spielberg, you know, obviously the director, and David Geffen, who was Katzenberg's sort of mentor and good friend, to get together and say, let's form a studio.
Well, I'd assume that you already have to be established in Hollywood to be able to go into a venture like this. So if someone were going to start a major movie studio, were these the perfect three to do it?
You know, at the time, everyone, there was every reason to believe they would succeed. I mean, they were, as I mentioned, Katzenberg was at the height of his powers.
Spielberg had a string of hits, and
yeah.
David Geffen was the king of the music business.
Yeah, and I mean, even that year, 1994, Spielberg had just won 10 Oscars for Schindler's List and Jurassic Park, so he was literally just at the apex of his career. And so everyone, you know, got very excited. Money was poured at them. They had nearly $3 billion in capital, and you know, everyone expected this to be a huge success.
But why a major Hollywood production studio? It can't be easy to create. People instead are more likely to do something a little more modest, independent, or try to develop a division of an established studio.
Mm-hmm. I think it was just at that time, and for those three guys who had done so much, you know, the next obvious thing was not to work at a studio, but to actually own a studio. And Spielberg especially, you know, dreamed of, you know, driving through the great gates of his own studio. And, you know, all of them had sort of, with the exception of Geffen, always worked for other people. So this was a chance to sort of become Hollywood elders and actually own their own enterprise.
And tell other people what to do instead
exactly.
of being told, you got to cut this again.
Yes.
How long had it been since a new movie studio had even been created in the United States?
It was 60 years. So this was really, you know, it was a major, major announcement and exciting event that drew, you know, attention from around the world.
Isn't a new studio always at a disadvantage when it comes to distributing the films?
Yeah, I mean, what's tough especially is that what really keeps studios afloat is when they have a library. And, you know, studios like Sony or MGM, you know, when you have a bad year, you have thousands, if not, you know, hundreds of thousands of old video titles that continue to make money. A new studio doesn't have that. So you don't go in with any backup financing or backup support.
Well, I remember in the old days, I actually worked many years ago for a law firm where they would try to get people to pay their bills. And one of the ways you did it is you said, well, if you don't pay us for this, you're not going to get the next one. But with the new studio, that doesn't really mean too much to people who don't want to pay.
Yeah, I know, but that's sort of where especially the allure of Spielberg came in. I mean, it was just so exciting to be able to work for him that they were able to really draw filmmakers and investors and get, you know, a lot of people behind them.
And you show the three of them on the cover. Are they the only major players involved in forming this company?
They're the three principals. You know, Steven Spielberg oversaw the live-action division. Jeffrey Katzenberg oversaw the animation. And Geffen was sort of behind the scenes and, you know, wooing investors and sort of doing the bigger deals. But, you know, in the book, I get into other executives. There was Walter Parks and Laurie MacDonald, who worked under Steven. They were his best friends. They ran the live-action studio. There was other executives at in animation. And then I also get into sort of players around Hollywood that intersect with the DreamWorks story, Michael Ovitz and Geffen and Michael Eisner at Disney and sort of his war with Katzenberg.
And Paul Allen from Microsoft.
Yes, exactly.
He really helped bankroll the thing, so I would think that he would have been a major part of this whole thing. Did he not want to be involved beyond being an investor?
Yeah, he was very hands-off. I mean, he put up $500 million to begin with to really get them, allow them to pass go. Ultimately, he would put in $700 million. But he wasn't interested in day-to-day, you know, getting involved. I mean, he was happy to just sort of support these guys and fly down and be friends with them. But he wasn't involved in actually running the company.
So he gave $700 million. How much did each of the principals give?
When they formed it, they each gave $33 million.
So we're talking about $100 million and $700 million. That's $800 million. That's an incredible amount of money.
Yeah.
Is it necessary to, I mean, can't you use other people's lots and stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, you absolutely can. But they really set out to do this sort of almost old-fashioned idea of a movie studio where they wanted to build a whole new state-of-the-art studio at Playa Vista. They wanted, you know, and it was a sprawling media empire that they planned. It wasn't just movies. It was video games and TV shows and record label. I mean, it was intended for this very elaborate company.
My guest is Nicole Laporte. Her book, The Men Who Would Be King, an almost epic tale of moguls, movies, and a company called DreamWorks. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I can't imagine that this was like one of those movies with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland where they say, let's put on a play. Was Spielberg just ready to sign on immediately? Was Geffen immediately ready to sign on?
It took a little persuading. I mean, Spielberg at the time was very comfortable. You know, he had his production company, Amblin, which was based at Universal. And he was in, you know, this wonderful position of being able to make any movie he wanted for whatever studio he wanted. He made, you know, this incredible deal where on films, on Jurassic Park, he made as much as Universal made. He made $300 million. So, you know, it did take some thought to sort of give that up, to jump into this startup company and take a risk. But like I was saying before, I think they were all at this stage in their lives, you know, they were in their 40s and 50s, and they were really ready to own something and have their name on it. You know, it was just sort of that baby boomer sort of desire at that stage to kind of become sort of the elders in Hollywood as opposed to the younger men.
But speaking of risk, isn't there always a risk when three people with reputations for having big egos try to work together?
Absolutely. But, you know, early on, there was just incredible confidence, and there was this kind of sense of invulnerability that these guys, you know, if anyone could do it, they could. And people were throwing money. It wasn't just Paul Allen. I mean, like I said before, they had nearly $3 billion in startup capital. So there was tremendous belief in these guys.
Because this was the all-star team.
Yeah, it was the dream team. That's what they, at their announcement that they had at the Peninsula Hotel, that's what they called themselves. And quickly, that's, you know, every newspaper around the world also, you know, used that moniker.
I'm assuming that very quickly they started running into problems in dealing with each other. Were they able to work them out at the start?
Yeah, I mean, they, if anything, they sort of moved into separate fiefdoms. I think there was some surprise when Jeffrey Katzenberg was not given the reign of the live-action studio, but was sort of pushed aside to animation. But, you know, he, I think, was so desperate to sort of create this company and have this post-Disney career that he sort of stuck it out and sort of, you know, was basically, for all intents and purposes, okay with it. But I think rather than collaborating, you just had three very powerful men who went off and sort of retreated to their various silos, and that's sort of how it worked.
And what was the plan from the start? A live action mostly, some animation? Was animation then on the upswing? Was anybody talking about 3D 11 years ago?
No. not really. Pixar was actually starting to experiment with it, but it was really, you know, Lion King had just come out, Little Mermaid, you know, it was just on the tail end or in the midst, actually, of this revival at Disney of these 2D animated films. And the plan was for DreamWorks to, you know, absolutely take Disney on. And actually, you know, Katzenberg wanted to beat Disney and, you know, one-up them. And those films made...
So this was a revenge project?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, many people claim that the reason DreamWorks was formed was to give Jeffrey a job and basically give him a platform to seek his revenge against Eisner.
Well, at the cost of billions of dollars.
Yes.
And possible failure.
Yes.
And their first film, The Peacemaker was their first film?
Yeah, The Peacemaker, it was sort of a big letdown because when they were formed, they were talking as though they were the next United Artists, you know, we're the inmates running the asylum, it's the artists, we're not corporate, we're not the suits, we're going to do things different, we're going to be better, we're not going to be Warner Brothers or Sony. And here, you know, you have Spielberg, the resident artist, running things, and then the first film was this, you know, it's a fine film, but it's basically a nice action movie starring George Clooney, who was then best known for ER, and directed by Mimi Leder, who had never directed a film before. So it was just sort of, you know, this kind of TV grouping and a nice, pleasant action movie, but nothing amazing, and it didn't really do great business.
And why would they start off with that? I would have imagined these guys who have all of this background and as we said, big egos, would want to start off with a real big splashy thing and then make movies like The Peacemaker and you know, try to mix it up.
Yeah, and absolutely, that's what everyone expected, but it just, you know, the whole, as I write about in the book, it just it got off to a very slow start. There was a lot of dysfunction. I mean, just getting that movie out the door was difficult. They really had the wrong people managing things at the live action studio, and I think it was just a very desperate, quick get this out. So their first movie was in 1997. They were formed in 1994. I mean, that's a very long time. They were very slow, and it did reach this sort of desperation point where they just needed movies. Now, also on the heels of Peacemaker, of course, they had Amistad, which was Spielberg's film, and which he sort of envisioned as this follow-up to Schindler's List. So I think that was more the special film, although that didn't work out.
Yeah,
either.
Amistad is not one of the films that immediately comes to mind when we think of Spielberg.
No, it was a huge disappointment. I mean, he was so upset about it that he gave back his director's fee. He was devastated when it was not nominated for any Academy Awards. I mean, it was one of his biggest disappointments.
In 1998, they released their first animated film, Ants, which did do fairly well.
Yeah, Ants did do well. It was made up of PDI, so they were actually, you had asked before about them getting into 3D, and 3D was just sort of bubbling. It was like Toy Story had come out, and sort of people were just waking up to the idea that there was this new format that was exciting that people liked. And so DreamWorks invested in PDI, which was a 3D studio in Northern California, and that's where they made Ants. So that actually was a 3D film, and yes, that did do well.
And did they start seeing animation as the future of the company's approach?
From the beginning, the idea was that animation would be the cash cow and that would be the division that sustained the studio and that's where all the money would come from. But aside from, I mean, Ants did well, but really the first few films, the animated films that Katzenberg released were actually mostly flops. So that sort of changed the strategy. It wasn't until Shrek came along in 2001 that they finally had this big animated hit.
Now, there was a period where animation was seen as too expensive. It's interesting that we come to a point where animation is seen as the future cash cow. Is that all because of computers?
Yeah, and just animated films beyond the box office. You know, they're family films. They draw in adults, kids. I mean, you can just count on getting the whole family in there. The merchandising opportunities are incredible. I mean, there's so many ways, you know, the Happy Meal tie-ins, they just really, they present an opportunity to make money that isn't so available with live action.
But did they have a vision? Did they want to make certain kinds of movies? Or was it just, hey, we like this project and we'll go ahead with this. This other one doesn't sound all that promising.
With the live action films, they
or any of the projects. It seems to me that again, when you start a studio, you usually have some idea. When United Artists started, you had a real sense of a studio with a vision. Here, it seems to me, it's all rather helter skelter.
It was, and you know, they stated that they would have a vision, and that was the intent. But it took them. I mean, there was a lot of years of fumbling, and it was almost like they fumbled on what their vision was. I mean, when American Beauty was made, that was sort of when DreamWorks declared, aha, this is a DreamWorks movie. This is the kind of movie. It's sort of different. It's edgy. It's not, you know, what Warner Brothers would make. But the irony,
but it's what Miramax would have made.
Yeah, and that's, and I think they were sort of going for a Miramax-type vision. But the irony is that American Beauty barely got made, and it was, Spielberg was the only one interested. Other executives wanted to pass on it. They killed Sam Mendes on the budget. I mean, it was made for $15 million. Everyone was ignoring it. And then it comes out, and once they saw it, they said, oh, my God. And, of course, it went on to win their first Academy Award. But that was, you know, they kind of stumbled into their identity, you know, as opposed to, you know, they did have, you're right, they did have trouble articulating it and sort of defining what it was.
My guest is Nicole Laporte, L-A-P-O-R-T-E. Her book, The Men Who Would Be King, an almost epic tale of moguls, movies, and a company called DreamWorks. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Nicole Laporte. Her book, The Men Who Would Be King, an almost epic tale of moguls, movies, and a company called DreamWorks. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. So they have a success, and then they have more success. They have a beautiful mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
DreamWorks ended the 2001 award season going out on top. They won the third consecutive Best Picture Oscar with A Beautiful Mind. And so they must have thought, well, we've figured it all out.
Yeah, they had. There was definitely a little the glory years of DreamWorks, where they had Saving Private Ryan, American Beauty, as you mentioned, A Beautiful Mind. And, you know, they were kind of becoming these regulars at the Oscars. And in the book, I talk about Terry Press, who was head of marketing, really sort of stealing some tricks from Miramax as far as aggressively marketing and sort of campaigning for films. And, you know, for several years, there was DreamWorks and Miramax battling it out at the Oscars.
How important was Terry Press to the success of the company?
She was a big player. I mean, at DreamWorks,
she didn't make the cover.
No, but she made the New York Times. So that matters. She was one, you know, she was this key player who had worked with Jeffrey at Disney and came over. And, you know, DreamWorks, they had no titles. There was just a lot of, you know, the hierarchy was less strict than it was at other studios. She was kind of right in there sitting with Jeffrey and David and Steven. And, you know, in Hollywood, a lot of a film's success has to do with marketing. And she was very innovative, very headstrong, and was brilliant at these Oscar campaigns. So she had a very big role.
Also, was able to tell Spielberg that he should put certain things in Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, she was a few, you know, Terry is a very brassy, take no prisoners, you know, she frightening to some, but, you know, just one of these women that Hollywood, there are other types like her that can just stand up to these men and sort of give it to them straight. And, you know, Spielberg especially is someone who's not used to being told when there's bad news. I mean, most of his handlers, most people. I mean, I've talked to, you know, other people who've worked in marketing departments. Or if his film doesn't test well, they don't want him to know. Or if it's a mess, they just won't tell him. And so, you know, not only was Terry just being blunt with him, just in her style, it's very aggressive. And I think he was, you know, taken aback. But, you know, she was actually right. I mean, she called it on Amistad. She said it wasn't working. She didn't think it was going to be nominated for Oscars. And then with Saving Private Ryan, right, she got him to, he was being very protective, and he didn't want to give her certain footage for the teaser trailer. And she's, you know, in that great scene where the mother falls to the ground when she sees the car pulling up and knows that, you know, this awful news that her sons have been killed, or son. And Terry just said, you've got to give me that. We need to, like, women, when women see that, they're going to want to go to this film that otherwise is really only appealing to young men and boys.
Then another film she had a major emotional commitment to was Dreamgirls.
Yes.
Now, it wasn't nominated for Best Picture. Some people felt it should have been. She was devastated.
Yeah. That film, I mean, a lot of people think that was over-marketed. I mean, a year before it came out, you had this teaser trailer out with the Jennifer Holliday song, and it was almost a year-long, very, very aggressive campaign that I think it hurt the film. And, you know, Terry has famously said, you never want to be the front runner. But by the time the award season rolled around, it very much felt that that was the front runner, and it was, you know, just as far as all the publicity and the marketing, they took footage to Cannes. It just, I think no one was able to really discover the film. And I think the expectations were so high that when people saw it, it was just sort of like, it's a nice film, but we were expecting, I don't know, Ben-Hur or something.
But the film did well at the box office.
It did do well. I mean, the main, you know, the big disappointment was just that it wasn't nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture.
It wasn't a reason she left DreamWorks, was it?
No, but by the end, she was just having trouble there. As far, you know, she didn't get along with Adam Goodman, who was a Spielberg protege, who ran the live action at the end. And I just think there was friction on a lot of levels. And when they moved to Paramount, she ended up not going with them.
So when did the problems arise? I know the company suffered a major setback after the release of Sinbad, Legend of the Seven Seas. How much money did they lose on that project?
I think it's something like $200 million. I have to look it up.
$200 million?
It was a lot of money. Yeah, I mean, they needed to go
to Paul Allen again.
Well, they did. They actually needed to go. After Sinbad, it was the first time David Geffen had always written into the business plan that, you know, there was a certain amount of liquidity he always wanted to have available. And when Sinbad completely bombed, it was the first time that amount of, you know, it was actually in the danger zone, so they did call Paul Allen.
But I don't understand how that works. They had all these hit films, which had made a lot of money. Does that money just disappear so that you're in a danger zone?
You make money, but DreamWorks, first of all, always had tremendous overhead. They were a huge operation. The animated campus was this sprawling Italian villa with a free food and, you know, koi ponds and Spielberg had his palace at Amblin. And films make money, but they cost a lot. And, you know, films became more expensive during the DreamWorks journey, and marketing them cost a lot. I mean, for a film to really be profitable takes, you know, you need more than just a hit. I mean, there's revenue and there's profit, and they just, the live action never really, never really was going strong in that area. I mean, animated films, Shrek helped. Shrek really kind of flush DreamWorks with a lot of cash, but you need more than one, you know, animated franchise to keep a studio afloat.
Was anyone blamed for the Sinbad disaster?
I think Katzenberg took a lot of responsibility, but it was, you know, an animated film's it's a collaboration. It's a lot of people working on it. But I think the agreement was that they had waited too long because that was a 2D film. And at that point, Pixar was doing very well. I mean, the shift to 3D had already begun, and Jeffrey did make a conscious decision to not move certain films into 3D, and I think that decision hurt Sinbad. I think if that had been a 3D film, it might have done better.
How did the deal with Paramount come about in December 2005?
They needed to sell at that point, and the animated studio had been spun off, so you were just left with live action, and there was really no justification anymore for having just a standalone independent live action studio. So David Geffen got involved. It was this long, drawn out process. At first, they were going to go to Universal, which is where Steven Spielberg really wanted to go. That he considered that his homeland. That's where Amblin had always been based. You know, the DreamWorks live action studio is still on the Universal lot. It's never left.
So why did they make such a bad deal with Paramount?
Well, they originally were going to go to Universal, and that GE didn't want to, you know, at that point DreamWorks films, there were more bombs, The Island bombed. It just started sort of, there was another losing streak, and GE didn't want to pay what Geffen wanted them to pay, so he sort of did this last-minute deal with Paramount. And Paramount at the time, Brad Gray had just come over to the studio and really needed product. You know, they needed to kind of breathe life into the studio. And they saw DreamWorks. He said, oh, we'll buy DreamWorks and this will help get us going again. And, you know, no one had any idea that there would just be so many personality clashes and that it would actually be the most disastrous marriage in recent Hollywood history.
But then War of the Worlds did okay and Paramount got most of the money. That didn't help DreamWorks either.
Yeah, yeah. Although DreamWorks did very well. I mean, they ironically had their best year ever once they went to Paramount. I mean, they had Norbit, they had Disturbia, they had Transformers. I mean, it was actually, and that was part of what led to the bad blood between Geffen and Sumner Redstone, was that Geffen felt he had undersold the company because it did go on to, you know, do incredibly well at Paramount.
My guest is Nicole Laporte. Her book, The Men Who Would Be King, an almost epic tale of moguls, movies, and a company called DreamWorks. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. So then, earlier this year, DreamWorks entered into a deal with the Walt Disney Company. Had Paramount given up on it?
things just got so bad between DreamWorks and Paramount that it wasn't going to work, and Geffen basically got in there and got them out of their contract, and it just had reached a completely untenable situation. And I think Geffen wanted to get out of the business entirely. Spielberg wanted to return to just having a small sort of production company, and so it just, you know, they're now at Disney, which ironically is, of course, as I was saying before, when DreamWorks was formed, it was sort of Jeffrey Katzenberg's revenge against Disney, and now the irony is that Jeffrey's not, but Spielberg and his company are now at Disney.
And Sally on the Upper East Side asks if there isn't another irony in the fact that DreamWorks had kind of imitated Disney repeatedly, the John Lasseter and Michael Eisner imitations.
Mm-hmm. In the films, or
in the way that they made films.
Yeah,
films
yeah.
Films like Shrek, for example.
Yeah, well, Pixar and DreamWorks, there was always this war going on with the animated films and claims that Jeffrey was stealing their idea. I mean, when Ants came out, Pixar had a movie called A Bug's Life that Jeffrey had known about when he was at Disney. So, of course, Pixar accused them of stealing that idea. And when DreamWorks did A Shark's Tale, and Pixar did Finding Nemo. So there was, again, you know, there was always this sniping and always this. But when you talk to people, you know, animators who work on these films, there were only a few, especially in the early days, there were only a few sort of storylines you could follow. Like when they made the Bugs movie, the technology at that time was you couldn't really do humans very well. So you sort of had to stick to cars and bugs and things like that. I mean, now it's evolved and you have films like The Incredibles, but some of it truly was, they were all sort of dealing with this very limited, these limited choices.
I don't know how much Spielberg got involved in the animation, but he did do an animated film, and that upset Art Spiegelman because it looked very much like Mouse, and Spielberg was accused of pretty much ripping off Art Spiegelman's idea.
Mm-hmm. Spielberg is frequently accused of ripping people off, and he's actually very sensitive about it. But it's, you know, it's part of what happens when a lot of successful directors are just always being, lawsuits or claims of stealing ideas. Because, of course, there's a lot of money to be made if you can prove that someone stole your idea.
Is it called American Tale? I think it looks very much like Mouse. But that's
yeah.
I'm not the judge in the case.
Yeah.
And I don't think it ever went to trial. We have the situation where Katzenberg is now with a company that he formed, as you say, as a kind of revenge against Disney. How did that work out?
So now DreamWorks Animation is its own company. It's distributed by Paramount, and Katzenberg runs it. And it's doing really well. They, you know, Shrek comes out this month. That is it's made $2 billion, just the first three films.
And then they had the Broadway show. That must have made some money.
The Broadway show, I don't think, it was canceled. It's, I think, just the economy, it just sort of came at the wrong time. So that actually wasn't, that wasn't a success. But that, again, as the caller was saying, it was following the steps of Disney, which, of course, has The Lion King and all of these shows on Broadway. But Jeffrey's doing very well. I mean, How to Train Your Dragon just came out and is doing well. So he's, he ended up with a company, and he did manage to sort of have a great second act.
Were they
ultimately
all willing to talk to you?
No, they were not.
So what happens when you go to them and say, I'm writing a book about DreamWorks? Do all of them not return your calls?
I wrote them letters. I mean, they were the first people I told when I got this book deal. I never tried to do any reporting without having them aware or asking for their participation. But they made it very clear they did not want to participate. Jeffrey Katzenberg actually made a lot of calls telling people to not talk to me. So there were a lot of scared sources. And so I had the reporting was often challenging and a delicate process. But luckily, there's so many people who have done business with the company and made movies there or work there that, you know, I talked to over 200 people and felt like I was able to kind of get around that.
Well, what's the current situation? David Geffen left?
Yeah, he sort of said goodbye to the movie business. I mean, I'm not sure there was talk of him buying the LA Times at one point. I mean, there was a point where he was talking to the New York Times. I think he's sort of looking into non-movie endeavors. I mean, when he
building buildings on the West Side Highway.
Yeah, right. But, you know, Dreamgirls, he was very involved with, and he said at the time, you know, this is my last movie. This is my swan song to the movie business. You know, I'm done with this. So, I mean, who knows? He'll keep us interested.
And Spielberg?
He is running what's known as DreamWorks 2.0, this company that's at Disney, and, you know, has a Lincoln film coming up and is back, you know, he's sort of back where he wants to be, which is overseeing a smaller company where he gets to really just worry about making movies, not, you know, running video game divisions and TV departments.
Your epigram is from Robert Penn Warren. The dream is a lie, but the dreaming is true.
Yeah, when I saw that, I knew that I would use that for this book, because I think, you know, as many things as went wrong with the company, there was a nobility to what they were trying to do, and I found myself, even as I was writing it, sort of rooting for them. And you know, they're working like crazy. Jeffrey's sweating. They're trying to make this thing go, and I think they really did believe they could be different, but it didn't work. So there's something sad about it.
Would you write anything about Variety, where you used to work? The situation there seems to be rather unhappy.
No, I don't think so. I think I stick to where I don't work.
They fired so many long-time people like Todd McCarthy. You're now at the Daily Beast?
I'm at the Daily Beast. Yeah, I'm the West Coast reporter in the L.A. office.
And did this grow out of the Variety reporting or the Daily Beast?
When I was at Variety, I covered DreamWorks for several years.
A listener from Brooklyn wants to know about the HBO series The Pacific. Where does that fit into the DreamWorks story?
That wasn't developed at DreamWorks. That's really more of an HBO project. But, of course, it is, you know, it's Spielberg and Tom Hanks' collaboration, which is a follow-up to their Band of Brothers project. So DreamWorks is involved, but it really is something that was developed at HBO, and it's more, it's more over there.
And Nicole Laporte, currently with The Daily Beast, her book, The Men Who Would Be King, an almost epic tale of moguls, movies, and a company called DreamWorks. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being
with
us.
Thank you so much.
On tomorrow's show, former First Lady Rosalynn Carter discusses the current state of the mental health profession, and then Pam Grier on her life and a career that's been filled with many memorable roles like Jackie Brown. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley on her latest, it's called Private Life, and humorist Dave Barry tells terrifying tales of adulthood. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Julia Corcoran, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Christine Black, David Ingram, and Jessica Ramey. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here at noon tomorrow.